few things to say. So there's lots of time for questions about the interpretation and thoughts you might have on it. So please interrupt me at any point and just feel free to chat. And then at the end, I thought I would talk a little bit about an interpretation which is similar to de Broglie-Bohm, but moving in the direction of many worlds, and some stuff we'll see in the next 2 days. So if we have time, I'll talk about those. Those are called modal interpretations. So I'm going to start by reviewing some of the stuff we saw yesterday. So this is the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation for two particles. So remember, the complete description is the wave function for the particles, and then a specification of the positions of each particle. And for more particles, it's similar. The wave function evolves according to Schrodinger's equation, but the particles evolve according to what are called the guidance equations, which are given by taking the wave function, decomposing it using the polar decomposition. S is the phase of the wave function in configuration space. And so to find the velocity of the first particle, you take the gradient with respect to R1 of the phase, you evaluate it at the positions of the Bohmian particles. And so it's a first order theory. Once you specify the positions of the particles and the wave functions, their velocities are specified. The other thing that defines the theory is what's called the standard distribution, which specifies that the statistical distribution of Bohmian positions is given exactly by psi squared. And what I showed you last time is that if you imagine that this holds at the initial time, then the dynamics, the way it's defined, guarantees that it holds at all later times. And this is key for showing that the predictions of Bohmian mechanics agree with the standard predictions of quantum mechanics. Right, and so then there was a couple of important concepts which I discussed. One was the concept of occupied and empty waves. So if I have a wave function, it's a superposition of a number of different terms. If your Bohmian position is in the spatial support of the jth term, then the jth wave is said to be occupied. If the Bohmian position is not in that spatial support, then that wave is said to be empty. And if you have these different psi j's having distinct spatial support, then only one of those waves is occupied. And if only the kth wave is occupied, then your guidance equation can be proven to depend only on the kth wave. So all the other terms in this superposition aren't relevant to the dynamics of the particle in that case. So one of the consequences of that was that for a product state, you could prove that the dynamics of particle 1 depended only on the wave function of particle 1, and the dynamics of particle 2 depended only on the wave function of particle 2. And you know, the thing we went on to show is that for entangled states, as long as only one of those terms is occupied, again, you get this independent dynamics. So where we ended last time was talking about reproducing the operational predictions. So we considered some measurement of a basis of the Hilbert space corresponding to phi k. So that's my system, couples to an apparatus, which couples to an environment. The apparatus and the environment come into states that depend on the state of the system, so they depend on k. And so if there's a superposition, we get this entangled state. And the point is that if the environment is typical, then for different states of the apparatus, for example, a pointer, the environment will go into different wave functions. Those wave functions will differ with respect to one or more of these coordinates. They'll be disjoint. So these overlaps will be roughly zero. And then the point is that if the jth wave comes to be occupied by the Bohmian position, right, so you evolve the Bohmian position along, it goes into one of those final waves, depending deterministically on where it started out. And then the only thing that's needed to figure out what the future dynamics of that Bohmian position is the jth wave in the superposition. You don't need all the other terms. So that's the sense in which you recover collapse. It's not a dynamical process. It's an effective process, right? So it just says that for the purposes of determining how the dynamics of the particle is going to work in the future, it's sufficient to just use the jth term, and you can ignore the rest of the terms. They're not relevant for the dynamics. So that's how Bohmian mechanics manages to be deterministic, because the wave function is evolving deterministically, the guidance equation is completely deterministic, but still recover the statistical predictions of quantum theory. It basically just says you have ignorance about where the Bohmian position is. That's why you can't predict the outcomes. The collapse of the wave function is just a convenience. It's not a fundamental process. Yes?
The spacious part of the waves is destroyed?
If we suppose that this spatial support of the different states of the environment are disjoint, then we guarantee that only one of these terms is an occupied wave, and that's why only one phi j is relevant for the dynamics.
So if originally we have a certain superposition of disjoint waves,
yeah.
Then how can it get from one to the other? Because there is zero probability between them, or something, or... And it seems like a special case when there's disjoint spatial support, right?
How can it get between them? Do you mean, if I take this example, suppose these phi k's have disjoint support,
mm-hmm.
okay? So I have, but what I start with is a wave function that's a superposition of many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Bohmian position is distributed according to the total wave function squared. So it could be anywhere. It could be in the support of any of them with probabilities corresponding to ck squared.
So you have the total wave function squared, which is just partitioned into the different specific states?
That's right. When I write the original wave function in this basis, that has no real significance in Bohmian mechanics. It's just a way of writing the total wave function.
Yeah.
So if I just wrote phi bar, hang on. So if I have a wave function, the particle, which is one of these superpositions of this basis, the Bohmian particle at this stage doesn't really care about this way of decomposing the wave function. You can decompose it lots of different ways. In the end, it only sort of matters what the overall phi squared is. That'll tell me what the probability of finding the Bohmian particle at various positions are. It's only when you interact with this measurement device that this basis becomes important, because this measurement device now picks out this basis and says it's the basis which becomes entangled. And if I rewrote this in some other basis, then the relative states of the rest of the system would not necessarily have this property.
Okay, but
yep.
The disjoint support property, isn't that like a very special case? I mean, like energy eigenstates would have that.
Right, which is why, let me sort of set up a, kind of a straw man. Suppose somebody said, why should I think of the wave function as collapsing to phi j, an element of this basis? Why don't I write down some other basis for the Hilbert space of the system, and then rewrite this guy in terms of that basis, tensor everything else, there's always a way of doing that, and say that it collapses to one element of that basis. How does the Bohmian particle know which basis, or how do we know which basis to compute occupied versus unoccupied waves relative to? So the answer is given by this sort of condition. There will be a basis picked out by the fact that the environment is going to go into states with spatially disjoint support. And intuitively, that's the basis you're measuring. And as I said last time, if you have an actual pointer, then very quickly, interactions with the environment are going to carry away information that will tell you that will encode in degrees of freedom that are spatially disjoint the information about the pointer. So if light, for example, bounces off my pointer, that light carries information about where the pointer was pointing. And it carries it in a way, the light pattern will go off in one direction if it's one position, or another direction if it's another position. And so ultimately, by measuring the position of the light that scattered off of my pointer, I could learn about the position of the pointer.
And so it's the fact that all measurements and all and most interactions, including interactions with the environment, tend to take away information about position. That's the fact that makes this basis preferred in this approach. Does that answer the question? Other questions about how Bowman mechanics reproduces the operational predictions? The reason we introduced the environment, you remember last time I had a slide without the environment, was that if for example, my system only interacts with one other degree of freedom, then I could imagine building an experiment that sort of reverses that interaction and makes it so that the terms in the wave function interfere again. And therefore, you know, the collapse would not be irreversible. I would find that the dynamics of the Bowman particle didn't depend entirely on just one term. If I re-interfered with other terms, I'd find that its dynamics depends on many terms in this equation. But once you've got the environmental interaction in there, and if the environment's big enough, then it becomes, in practice, impossible to sort of collect all the degrees of freedom in the environment, evolve them backwards to a situation where you can see the coherence between different terms here. The reason this is, you know, effective irreversibility is the same reason that it would be incredibly difficult to prepare a Schrodinger cat state, that you'd have to isolate your system from the environment to be able to measure interference between the alive and the dead state. And that's incredibly hard to do if you've got a large number of degrees of freedom, because just one of them interacting with the environment is enough to destroy the coherence and make it impossible to see the interference. So the Bohmian interpretation makes use of the extreme effectiveness of decoherence to its advantage. So from the perspective of somebody who wants to verify the existence of macroscopic superpositions, decoherence is a real problem. But if you're trying to interpret quantum theory in this way, decoherence is indispensable for making sure that you can get something that looks like an irreversible collapse. We'll be talking a bit more about decoherence further on. Okay. Now, I wanted to say something about ways in which this interpretation could deviate from the predictions of quantum mechanics. So what I've shown you is that as long as you assume the standard distribution and as long as your coupling to your apparatus has certain features, you expect to get the predictions of quantum mechanics. But there's an idea out there which leads to predictions that are slightly different from quantum theory. So let me tell you a little bit of the motivation behind this idea. If you look at the formalism of the interpretation, you notice that the wave function plays a few roles. You'll remember we had that discussion about, you know, ontic and epistemic concepts. So if you think of the wave function as a guiding wave, as a pilot wave, so that's one of the roles it plays in this model, then it seems to be ontic because it's it pushes the particles around in different ways depending on what wave function you have. So as I vary the parameters in the wave function, the way particles move changes. So that certainly feels like a description, a change in the way reality is. Two universes that have different wave functions evolve in different ways. They seem to be different universes. And then on the other hand, you've got this postulate that the distribution of the Bohmian positions, which you could think of as specifying what an agent knows about the Bohmian position, is given by psi squared. So again, psi is appearing, but now it has this completely epistemic role to play in describing what an agent knows about the Bohmian position. So you might be unhappy with that it's playing this dual role. You know, it should, you might argue, it should either be a purely epistemic thing or it should be a purely ontic thing, but it doesn't really make sense to say, for example, if the wave function really just described an agent's knowledge, how could it push particles around? I mean, it's something in my head if it describes my knowledge of the Bohmian positions. So it would be inappropriate to imagine that it's determining how particles move. Conversely, if it's truly ontic,
then why should the distribution over Bobian positions be fixed by psi squared? You know, why should they be tethered to that particular distribution? So this point has been made by Antony Valentini, who's somebody who works on Bohmian mechanics. And he decided that it's a good idea to try to make the wave function purely ontic in this approach. And he said, so let's assume that the standard distribution postulate fails. So suppose the wave function squared, psi squared, looks like this. So you have a two-dimensional space. But your distribution of Bohmian positions starts out looking like something completely different. Okay, so now what you know about the Bohmian position has nothing to do with psi squared. So that at least resolves this tension in the formalism. But now you have a problem with reproducing the quantum predictions. Well, what Valentini was able to show in first some theoretical work and then some numerical simulations, here I'm plotting the simulations, what he was able to show is that if the dynamics has certain features, then over time, the distribution of Bohmian positions goes over to psi squared on a coarse grain scale. So he likened this to the H theorem in statistical mechanics. And so here in this numerical simulation, he has a wave function evolving. You can see it's sort of changing. It's periodic. And then this is what the distribution looks like. So over time, it changes. And eventually, on a coarse grain scale, it comes to resemble psi squared. So the idea here is that as long as the systems have had enough chance to equilibrate, so to interact with the wave function in the dynamics, then when we do measurements, we should expect to see the standard distribution. And the deviations from the standard distribution will be very small and extremely difficult to detect, so it's reasonable that we wouldn't have seen them if we were looking for them. There are a lot of caveats that go with this. So it's if you have some exotic distributions to start with, then this won't happen. So for example, if I put all the weight on a node of the wave function, then clearly it wouldn't converge to this. But the idea is that for most distributions, you will get this equilibration process. And Valentini calls this quantum equilibrium. So eventually, systems come to quantum equilibrium in Bohmian mechanics, and then they're distributed according to psi squared, and then every prediction is in accord with operational quantum theory. So this is not the only version of Bohmian mechanics that people espouse. There's another school, which is often associated with Goldstein, Durr, and Zanghi, which takes the standard distribution to be part of the theory. There's no deviation from the standard distribution according to them. So they have some statistical arguments involving typicality to argue for their view. But I'm going to mostly talk about this perspective here. And one of the interesting things is that it means that there are conceivably some experiments that could falsify quantum theory in support of this sort of model. So Valentini has made some suggestions about where you might find matter that is out of quantum equilibrium. And so he imagines, for example, that if you have some matter that's been very isolated since the beginning of the universe, since the Big Bang, then that might be a good candidate for something that's not come to quantum equilibrium. Or he imagines that if you have some matter that's close to, that's very exotic in some way, like maybe near a black hole where we don't quite understand the physics, maybe that's a good place to find a deviation from quantum equilibrium. And incidentally, if you do have matter outside of quantum equilibrium, then you can sort of figure out what this model says will happen. So it leads to all sorts of new predictions, like being able to signal faster than the speed of light and being able to discriminate non-orthogonal quantum states and a bunch of things which are not true of quantum theory. So I think this is a really nice example of what we talked about on day one, which is that if you take a particular realist strategy, then although your first goal might be, I want to reproduce the predictions of operational quantum theory, ultimately the picture it gives you might lead you to suggest something that does go beyond quantum theory and to test that experimentally. So, whereas you may have heard if you've heard of bumming mechanics at all, that it's sort of indistinguishable from quantum theory. That's true to some extent. But it leads you to suggestions, which are very particular suggestions about how quantum theory might fail. So questions about that?
How does one know what an isolated system is, given that interactions can be really non-local? How do you actually discern what could be isolated?
That's a good question. I don't think I'm qualified to answer it. I haven't studied Valentini's work in enough detail to know what are the explicit conditions under which you expect to not achieve quantum equilibrium. It might have to do with the nature of the wave function, that the wave function doesn't lead to kind of a mixing dynamics of the Bohmian positions. So typically, dynamics in Bohmian mechanics is quite chaotic. And maybe you need something like some ergodic assumptions to hold to get this equilibration. So you try to find scenarios where those assumptions don't hold. I can point you to Valentini's papers where he talks about this in more detail. Move on. So the next topic I wanted to say a few words about
was something about ultimately about talking about contextuality. But first, I just want to ask, to what extent do say position measurements reveal the position of the Bohmian particle? So we now say that there's a hidden variable which we're describing as the Bohmian particle's position. And we're doing position measurements, so it would be nice if the position measurements revealed those positions. So what you find is that if you take any function of the position observable in quantum theory, and you calculate the expectation value for some quantum state, and then over here you take the distribution over Bohmian positions, and that same function of the Bohmian position, and you integrate over position, you find exactly the same values. So the mean position in quantum mechanics corresponds to the mean position of the Bohmian particle, and the variance in position corresponds to the variance in position of the Bohmian particle. So that's quite nice. I'll call that statistical faithfulness. But now if you look at momentum measurements, it's not quite so nice. So you also have a Bohmian momentum, which is just the mass times the velocity of your Bohmian particle. So you can calculate the average momentum of your Bohmian particles. And in that case, you find it corresponds exactly to the expectation value of the quantum momentum operator. But if you look at, say, the kinetic energy, or the expectation value of the momentum squared, that does not agree with the expectation value of the kinetic energy of the Bohmian particles. So you can't just imagine that such a measurement is revealing the properties of the underlying Bohmian particles. So in general, what happens is that it's not enough if you want to know, what are you measuring when you measure p squared? You need to know more than just the Bohmian particle velocities, and you need to know something about how that measurement was done. So if you tell me everything about how the measurement was implemented, then it's possible to extract these kinds of quantities from Bohmian positions and velocities and the wave function in general. But the actual mapping tends to depend on differences in the setup that ultimately don't make a difference to these quantum expectation values. They do make a difference to the mapping between these expectation values and the properties of the Bohmian particle. So that should remind you of this phenomenon of contextuality that we talked about earlier. Another point is that if you look at a natural candidate for an energy. So if you take, for example, these are the Bohmian velocities here. So if you take a kinetic energy for the Bohmian particles and say the potential evaluated at the position of the Bohmian particle, and then this is the quantum potential. So you could throw that into your definition of the energy of the Bohmian particle. If you recall the imaginary part of the Schrodinger equation had this form, then it means I can rewrite this energy just as minus ds dt evaluated at the position of the bubbling particle. And that's sort of natural because, you know, the phase factor of an energy eigenstate, for example, is e to the I energy times time. So if I'm taking this partial derivative, I'll tend to pull down an energy, at least for those wave functions. So this is a candidate for a definition of energy of the Bohmian particle. And you might say, is it conserved? That's something that you might want energy to satisfy. And you find it's not. It's not conserved in detail, but if, so for a particular Bohmian position, if I follow the trajectory, I can find that this energy is not conserved. But if I take the average over the distribution of Bohmian positions, then that average ends up being just the quantum expectation value for the Hamiltonian. So again, you see that, you know, statistically, certain quantities map on, have a map, or certain quantities, when I evaluate the expectation value for the Bohmian value of that quantity, I get the quantum expectation value. But, you know, something that I might have expected to hold at the deeper level of individual trajectories does not, namely energy conservation. So let me give you another example of contextuality. This one is due to Lucien Hardy. It's very simple. So the idea is this. Imagine you're doing one of two different measurements. And ultimately, the measurement is just determining whether a single particle is coming into this box along this channel or along this channel. So sometimes in quantum optics, these are called dual rail degrees of freedom. So it's really just a two-level system. It can either be here or it can be here. And so this is going to be a measurement of, both of them are going to be measurements of which rail the particle is coming in on. The first measurement basically has, it directs the paths along these lines. It puts detectors here. And then it's hard to see in this picture, but imagine there was a third dimension. These paths don't overlap with one another. So they pass beside one another in a third dimension. And so clearly, if I find a detection here, I infer the particle came in here and vice versa. So if I want to describe this by some projector-valued measure in quantum theory, I will do it with some pair of projectors which distinguish those two rails. So where's my chalk gone? If say phi A is the state corresponding to coming in on the first rail, then the measurement is just this, phi A versus phi B. Phi B is projector for states coming in along the second rail. So that's the measurement associated with the first box. The second box is exactly the same, except now these two paths do cross in two dimensions, right? So they do overlap. If I solve the Schrodinger equation for this wave packet here, and I solve a Schrodinger equation for this wave packet here, and then I imagine that instead of having a wave packet coming in just in the top ray or just in the bottom ray, I have a superposition of the two, then because unitary evolution is linear, this wave function is going to evolve in exactly the same way regardless of whether there's another wave function here. So these two wave functions just aren't going to see one another at all. I'm just going to get a superposition of, you know, phi A evolving down here, phi B evolving down here. And then when I do the measurement, it allows me to determine whether the particle came in here or here. So this is, in quantum mechanics, just another way of implementing a measurement of which rail the system came in on, and it doesn't have any different predictions from the first one. They both yield the same statistics for all preparations. So is that clear? Why that's the case? I kind of went through the explanation quickly because I didn't want to belabor it, but.
Just an ominous silence. I'll assume that it makes sense. And then let's talk about, you know, what Bohmian mechanics predicts. Well, we already saw last lecture that there's no crossing of trajectories in this theory. because it's a first order theory. So once you specify the position and the wave function, the velocity at every position is fixed. And so over here, where the two paths don't overlap, they pass one another in the third dimension, the trajectories of the Bohmian particles can just be straight lines, because this is not really crossing Bohmian trajectories. They fail to cross because of this extra degree of freedom in the third dimension, or they avoid crossing. Whereas here, if they're confined to a two-dimensional plane, as I assumed, then they really cannot cross, and so every Bohmian particle that comes in on the top has to go out at the top. This is sort of my artist's rendition of what it might look like if you actually started with some Gaussian wave packets and evolved them forward. This is not a numerical simulation. This is just kind of roughly how it would look. And so this is a very peculiar situation, because normally we would say, you know, if you get a detection over here, that corresponds to the projector onto phi b. In quantum mechanics, that allows you to retrodict that, you know, had I put a quantum state in with zero amplitude here and all the amplitude there, then I'd definitely get this outcome. So it suggests that you should think that the particle was here. You know, even if I put a coherent superposition of 1 over root 2 phi a, 1 over root 2 phi b, when I get a detection here, I usually think of that as having found the particle here. Incidentally, I think I forgot to say this explicitly, both of these graphs are for the Bohmian trajectories under the assumption that this is the wave function, that you have an equal superposition of phi a and phi b. So this sort of makes sense, that you know, you find a detection here, you can infer that the Bohmian position was here. But in this case, whenever you get a detection here, you infer that the Bohmian position came in the top. Statistically speaking, there's no problem, because for this wave function, about half of the trajectories, you know, you have a probability of half of the trajectories coming in here, probability of half of the trajectories coming in here, you'll get 50-50 statistics, and that's in accord with quantum theory. But your intuitions about what it means for the position of the particle are completely wrong in this situation. Another way of saying that is that if I want to represent this measurement by some indicator functions in the hidden variable model, then I might say that you know the indicator function that represents this outcome is one that you get probability one for this outcome whenever the particle is in this bottom region. So I could do something like this. If I have a space of positions of my Bohmian particle, then I would say an indicator function like this, which detects whether the particle is in the lower region, that's the one that corresponds to getting the up outcome given x. And then there would be an indicator function here, which corresponds to the probability of getting the down outcome given x. So that's the first measurement. And then the second measurement, if I look at the indicator functions for up and down, they're reversed. So this indicator function is the one that corresponds to the up outcome. And this indicator function here is the one that corresponds, middle. This indicator function would correspond to down, whereas over here, the top indicator function corresponds to down. So this would say that even though the statistics of these two measurements are exactly the same for all preparations, the set of indicator functions I use to represent them are different in this hidden variable model. Therefore, it's a measurement contextual hidden variable model. I mean, it's also peculiar. So earlier we saw that all the moments of the position distributions in quantum mechanics were reproduced by the moments of the Bohmian distribution over positions. But here, position measurements, although statistically faithful, they're not outcome faithful. So you know, the fact that the Bohmian position is here does not fix what outcome I'm going to get. If I'm doing this experiment, I'll get this outcome. If I'm doing this experiment, I'll get this outcome. So you know, if I think of this measurement, the quantum measurement, as a projection onto two intervals of space, that, you know, which projection I get need not correspond to where the Bohmian particle was. So that's the sense in which it's not outcome faithful.
So some people have said this is too weird, and they've described these kinds of trajectories as surrealistic, and they say this is evidence why you shouldn't believe in Bohmian mechanics. But of course, defenders of Bohmian mechanics will say, well, there's no problem with reproducing the predictions of quantum mechanics. It may be counterintuitive, it might defy your classical intuitions, but it's still a viable theory because it does justice to the phenomena that we observe. The bottom line is that you have to be very careful in invariable models, such as Bohmian mechanics, with associating attributes of the particles, like position, momentum, and so forth, with the operator in quantum theory that has the same name. They might not correspond very closely to one another. And secondly, you really need to tell me exactly how you're doing the experiment for me to be able to make the association. For a given Bohmian position, what sort of outcome are you going to get? So in a sense, there's in this interpretation, it reminds you of Bohr's philosophy, where you say without a full description of the experimental arrangement, you always need a full description of the experimental arrangement to make appropriate statements. So that's certainly true here. One criticism that you could make out of this phenomena is that this kind of contextuality we're seeing here is not needed, in a sense. I cannot, from this difference of how to implement this measurement, I can't derive a no-go theorem. I can't prove that all hidden variable models have to have this kind of contextuality. So remember that when we had those no-go theorems, there were things like, if I change the ensemble I use to form a mixed state, that notion of a context can lead to a contradiction. Or if I change in a three-dimensional Hilbert space, I have two bases which have an element in common. That kind of change in context can lead to a contradiction. But things like two ways of measuring polarization using a birefringent crystal or a piece of Polaroid, that wasn't the kind of difference of context that led to a contradiction in our proofs. Nor is this one. We're just talking about one measurement in a two-dimensional Hilbert space being implemented in two ways. There's nothing. I'm not talking here about two ways of decomposing a quantum object, like a rank 2 projector into rank 1 projectors. That was the kind of ambiguity in the quantum formalism that supported all those contradictions. Here, there's nothing like that. There's just, you know, two rank 1 projectors in both cases, and so there's no difference in how I represent it quantum mechanically. There's only a difference in how I describe the measurement. So it's a kind of context which we can't prove every hidden variable has to have, at least not obviously, and yet Bohmian mechanics has it. So you might say, it would have been nice to have a hidden variable model that only posited contextuality when it was really needed. You know, that only posited contextuality because, you know, it was on pain of contradiction that it had to use that kind of contextuality. All right. What about the classical limit of Bohmian mechanics? So it depends to some extent what you mean by the classical limit. So you could have a notion of classical limit that was appropriate for an operationalist. You say classical experiments give us certain kinds of statistics, and the question is, can Bohmian mechanics reproduce those sorts of statistics? Well, that kind of correspondence comes along if you manage to show that your interpretation reproduces the operational predictions. So if you can get the operational predictions of quantum theory, and you can prove that when your experiment satisfies certain criteria of classicality, you reproduce the operational predictions of a classical theory, then you know, you'll have this kind of correspondence. So basically, as long as you have the standard correspondence with quantum theory, you can get operational correspondence with classical theories. The more interesting sort of correspondence for a hidden variable model or any realist interpretation would be, can you somehow recapture the ontology that was posited in our classical theories, you know, prior to the quantum revolution? So if I have a non-relativistic system, you know, can I recover in some limit the Newtonian picture of the world? So it turns out that look, you could ask whether you could recover Newtonian trajectories for macroscopic objects. That would be one example of this. And you can't really, because this non-crossing phenomena of trajectories that we have seen means that the kinds of trajectories you'll see in Bohmian mechanics don't correspond to Newtonian trajectories. It's the difference between the first order nature of the theory and the second order nature of Newtonian mechanics. So even for macroscopic objects, if I could engineer a situation where I have some kind of interference, some kind of wave functions overlapping, such that the trajectories might cross one another, then I'll see differences between the Bohmian trajectories and the Newtonian trajectories. So there's actually a famous example of chaotic motion of one of the moons of Saturn, I believe, which if you imagine that the dynamics were totally quantum, the spread of the wave function would become sort of large and observable on a time scale that is, you know, only 10 years or so. So you could imagine, I'm going to tell you, you know, what how we'll salvage classicality in that case. But if really that moon of Saturn were totally isolated, you could imagine that, you know, its actual trajectories over a span of many years might be different according to Bohmian mechanics than they would be in a Newtonian theory. But there's a response to that objection, which is to, again, appeal to decoherence. So, you know, the problem with non-crossing trajectories goes away if those two wave packets that are coming in become correlated with some other degree of freedom. So if I have an environment that carries information away, then all of a sudden I can have the non-crossing occur in the configuration space of the environment. So as long as my environmental degrees of freedom don't overlap in space, then it doesn't matter if my system's degrees of freedom overlap in space. So I could just couple my system, to example, to a spin and have the spin be different depending on whether the particle's coming in this way or this way. And then even though they overlap in space, because they don't overlap in the spin degree of freedom, they could pass through one another. So the argument that proponents of Bohmian mechanics give is that any system that's obeying classical physics is not only going to be potentially large, but it's also going to be exposed to its environment. It's going to be decohering and becoming entangled. And therefore, Bohmian mechanics will predict that it's the trajectories of such systems can cross, because all these environmental degrees of freedom will ensure the non-crossing in the overall configuration space. Good. So, questions about the classical limit?
I mean, another thing you could say about the classical limit is that if you look at the quantum potential, for example, and you know, it has an h bar in the numerator, something like h bar grad squared r over r. So if h bar is small, then this is going to be negligible compared to your regular potential. If the wave function changes slowly, then this can also be small. So you have certain conditions wherein you expect the quantum potential won't change the dynamics much relative to the external potential. And the whole discussion I just gave is that even if those conditions are satisfied, okay, these sort of normal conditions of non-classicality, which are the kinds of conditions that you would see in Ehrenfest theorem, even if those are satisfied, you still have this first order, second order difference that you have to worry about. And that's the thing that you have to appeal to decoherence to solve. Okay, so there's a few more criticisms of Bohmian mechanics I want to go over, and they all have a similar flavor. Yes?
So when you compare it, H-bar to doing something small, what do you compare it to?
Yeah, I don't know if I have all the terms in this, but there's a dimensionless quantity defined by the quantum potential, and that's the thing that you want to be small. So really, you need to look at things like the length scale over which your wave function squared varies. That's the sort of quantity that you look at in the Ehrenfest theorem. I mean, people do sometimes point out that if h bar were to go to zero, then this term would disappear, but I agree with you that it's sort of not a really interesting limit. So the next set of criticisms all relate to underdetermination. So this is a term that philosophers use. And it describes the situation where you might have many possible choices of ontological structure that are consistent with observations. So philosophers often worry about, you know, could it be that all the observations we see are consistent with two pictures of what the way the world is? And if so, then that, doesn't that make sort of both those pictures of the way the world is implausible because we can't decide between them? And maybe it makes the whole realist program, maybe it poses a problem for realist interpretations in general. And to some extent, this is a bit like what we talked about concerning Plato's cave. If the color of the three-dimensional objects that cast the shadows can't be discriminated by the shadows, then you might say, well, the color is underdetermined by the phenomena, therefore we shouldn't posit the existence of color. It doesn't have any explanatory power. So
there's a few different kinds of underdetermination. One of them, it concerns what sorts of variables you add in addition to the wave function. So the formulation we've been talking about is one where position is a preferred variable because it's the, for a single particle, for example, it's the extra variable that we have to add in addition to the wave function to get the complete description of reality. Now, let me just rewrite the guidance equation in this way. So remember, it was grad S over M. It turns out that it's possible to rewrite the guidance equation as a probability current over R squared. Remember, R is the magnitude of the wave function. So this is basically psi squared. And the probability current is just what you might remember from textbook quantum mechanics, psi star grad psi minus psi grad psi star. It turns out, I won't go through the math, but this expression is exactly minus grad S over M. So this is just another perfectly valid way of writing the guidance equation. And it sort of makes sense because a probability current divided by a probability density ought to be a velocity field. And that's what we're looking for. You know, we take that velocity field at R, evaluate it at the Bohmian position, and we get the velocity of the Bohmian particle. So I just need this to tell you about the next variant of Bohmian mechanics, which is one wherein you take the momentum to be your preferred additional variable, additional to the wave function. So this is something that was proposed immediately after Bohm put out his paper on the subject in the 50s by Epstein. And so now here's the idea. You write the wave function down in the momentum representation. That's part of the description of reality. But you also assign to your particle a momentum. I'll call it pi. So this is like zeta was the Bohmian position, pi is the Bohmian momentum. So in momentum space, I would have that my particle at some position in momentum space or some spot in momentum space, and the wave function, both. The way the wave function evolves is just according to the Schrödinger equation. I can express it in the momentum representation if I want. And then you can define a probability current over momentum. So, roughly speaking, you could write down a conservation equation for probability of a given momentum. So I write psi squared in the momentum basis, and I demand that, the rate of change of that probability is given by the grad of a current field. That's this current field here. I won't write out an equation for it, but that's its definition. So I can just take the current field over momentum divided by psi squared in the momentum representation, which I've written here as r squared of p. That's just the r for psi in the momentum representation. And I have now an equation for how p changes. And so I can say, well, here's my theory. Everything has a well-defined momentum. Those momenta undergo evolution in momentum space according to some trajectories. And that's what's going on. Yes?
Sorry, it's pi that's changing. Yeah, pi is my notation for the Bohmian momentum. So yeah, it's pi that's undergoing, pi of t is the trajectory of the momentum of the particle. In this sort of theory, you can also define a position of the Bohmian particle, but it's not related to momentum in the standard way. So for example, the rate of change of that position is not does not relate to momentum by just pi equal to mv. It's more complicated, but you can define it. It's kind of an effective derived quantity in this sort of approach. Just like in the other approach, we had velocities
for our particles, right? So you tell me the Bohmian position, you tell me the wave function, it implies a velocity. There's no freedom in specifying the velocity. It's not an independent degree of freedom, but I can define a velocity in terms of the underlying degrees of freedom. Similarly here, for every pi, every momentum, and every wave function, it implies a particular position that the particle's at. If you look at the predictions of this theory, they're very bizarre, very unintuitive things are going on. But you can argue, so there's a paper by Ward Stroiva, who was a postdoc here and started thinking about this work while he was at PI. You can argue that when you just ask, can I reproduce the operational predictions of quantum mechanics using this sort of model, the answer is yes, you can. So I won't go into the details of those arguments, but let me just take my word for it that they're quite plausible that you can do this. And if you can, then other choices, of course, are possible. You could take linear combinations of position and momentum. So there's all these different possibilities for what your underlying hidden variable model could look like. And they all seem to do justice to the operational predictions. So that could be a problem. Another place where the problem arises is if you want to do a de Broglie-Bohm theory for the electromagnetic field, then you have a worse kind of symmetry, because the status of the electric and the magnetic field, they're also complementary variables, as position and momentum are. But typically, they appear in a more symmetric fashion in the Hamiltonian. And so it's even harder to make the call between which one of them should be your preferred variable, even harder than it is in the case of position and momentum, where your potentials tend to make things simpler for position, or your intuitions tend to suggest that position is somehow more fundamental than momentum. So you also have a problem of underdetermination there. If you want to treat spin, so this question came up last time, you again have multiple choices for how you might do it. So I'm not going to go into detail into these models, but so there's a model which was proposed by Bohm and some collaborators where your supplementary variables, so the stuff that you add to the wave function, is both a particle position and a kind of orientation in space. So every particle has an orientation in space. So there's like a little sphere of possible directions. And that's now an extra degree of freedom. Or another way to put that is that it's, the particle is taken to be some sort of extended rigid object, which makes a spin contribution to the total angular momentum. So it's actually spinning in this model. And you can show that you can reproduce the operational predictions of quantum mechanics with that sort of model. But there's another approach, which John Bell proposed, and it's a more minimalist approach, where you say, no, the supplementary variable is just particle position. There is no extra stuff corresponding to orientation of some extended object. It's just particle position. And the effect of spin degrees of freedom is seen through the dynamics of those particle positions. So if my wave function does have spin degrees of freedom, then if I look, I can define a guidance equation for my particle position that responds to what the spin of the wave function is. And so I can have spin-based effects even though I don't have a spin degree of freedom in the model. And you can reproduce the predictions because when we read out pointers, again, we tend to look at the positions of macroscopic objects. We don't have direct access to their spin. So we're not monitoring spin degrees of freedom when we're looking at our apparatuses. So let me tell you a little bit about the details of this model. So it's, yes.
And the top one,
yeah.
Where you assume the particle is extended rigid object.
Yeah.
Does it have some kind of classical notions? I'm thinking that there's a problem with extended objects when you consider electrodynamics. Before we had quantum electrodynamics, there is this problem with deacceleration, that if you have a highly relativistic system, so an accelerating charge, then it would accelerate before it feels any influence. It's something unphysical.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens because you have extended objects.
Mm-hmm. So this extended object doesn't need to be presumed to be the charged object that's interacting with the magnetic field. But I think there are problems of a similar sort. So from what I remember, you can show that this object has to, if it really is extended, then the point on the object has to be actually moving superluminally to be able to do justice. to spin degrees of freedom. So there's going to be a lot of violations of relativity in this sort of model. But people who propose these things have considered that to be a problem, that you need to have superluminal motions of your extended object. Yes?
If you have an extended object, how do you recover any kind of fermionic statistics? Like if you rotate it once around its own axis, it's going to be the same object, not the opposite. So.
Well, you can still say what happens to the wave function if I do this rotation. So the wave function is part of the total description. So you might say, right, the degree of freedom of my supplementary variables has gone back to the same thing, but the wave function has changed. Therefore, I can potentially still take those effects into account.
So you put it in by hand.
Well, I don't know about or if it's appropriate to say putting it in by hand.
Is it derived from something?
What's that?
Is it derived from something? Like the change of sign of the wave function?
Whatever is true of the wave function in normal quantum mechanics, however it evolves, so you know, you've rotated your electron by 2 pi, it's picked up an negative sign. That will also be true of the wave function in this approach, because the wave function just obeys the Schrodinger equation. So the question really is the experimental phenomena that see the difference between fermions and bosons, you know, different sorts of experimental statistics. Can I reproduce that, those predictions, if I have the wave function together with this extra variable? And you know, here we're showing that even though you don't posit any extra degree of freedom to describe the spins, the very fact that the spin influences the wave function can allow you to reproduce those predictions. So maybe let me take a moment to explain how this works more carefully, and then I'll take the rest of the questions. So this is Bell's minimalist approach to spin. Again, now you have a two-component wave function, because that's where the spin...
That's how we model the spin degree of freedom. So it's not just a scalar over space. It's a two-component wave function. But again, the supplementary variable is only particle position. And then if you ask, how should that wave function evolve? Well, it's just the Pauli equation. So this is the vector potential. I imagine that there's a magnetic field that couples to the Pauli operators. And that's how the two-component wave function evolves for such a system. And so the Bohmian assumes that that's how their wave function evolves. And then they write down a guidance equation for the position, which now involves, again, the same expression, probability current over probability density. The probability density is given by the sum of the densities of the two spin components. The probability current is a sum of current terms for each spin component and a term that involves the vector potential, which is sort of the standard textbook probability current for the Pauli equation. So if you do that, you can get some trajectories. And what you find is that you can, again, reproduce the operational predictions. If you look at something like the Stern-Gerlach experiment, what you find, so you've got, you know, your magnet here. It looks something like this. And you've got particles coming in and being deflected, and then you measure them on a screen. And if you find them on the upper half plane, then you conclude that it was spin up. And if you find them deflected downwards, you conclude it was spin down. So this is something that requires a coupling of the spin of this particle to the inhomogeneous magnetic field here. In the Bohmian picture, Bell's version of this, what happens is that it's the position in the original wave packet that determines where it ultimately ends up on the screen. So the dynamics of this guy is what sort of feels the spin degree of freedom. There is no underlying spin degree of freedom, just particle position. But where you are here determines where you end up. And you reproduce all the predictions. If you say, what's the probability that I'll find the particle up here? It's exactly the quantum probability. What's the probability you find it here? The quantum probability. So Bell pointed out that you actually, you know, don't need to introduce extra degrees of freedom into the supplementary variables. It's enough for them to be there in the Schrodinger equation. They can influence the supplementary variables you've already postulated. So you could say something similar about fermionic degrees of freedom. In fact, I think my next example, I'm not going to say anything about underdetermination in how to model fermions. I'm not an expert on this, but I think that there are a few different proposals for what a bohmionic theory of a, not bohmionic, a Bohmian theory of fermions would be. But let me, before I'll get to fermions, I'll say something very minimalist about fermions. But are there more questions about spin? Yes?
So I understand the only way to visualize the spin of a particle is just by kind of sort of a Stern-Gerlach experiment?
It's saying this, that when we ask, you know, what are the indicator functions over the hidden variables that correspond to, say, the measurement of Z spin. So we have these projectrons, Z spin up, projectrons, Z spin down. What am I learning about the hidden variables of the initial state? The answer in Bell's minimalist approach is you're learning something about the position of the particle. When you find that it's spin up, you learn that, oh, it was in the upper half plane. That's where its position was initially. When you learn to spin down, you learn that the particle is initially in the lower half plane. So ultimately, in this approach, a measurement of spin is just a measurement of some coarse-grained properties of position. That's all it is. Whereas in the other approach, there were some degrees of freedom associated with spin, and your measurements might depend on those degrees of freedom as well. Good. So let's talk just a little bit about quantum electrodynamics. Again, I'm not an expert on this, but Bohm himself had a model, a Bohmian type model for the electromagnetic field, and the supplementary variable, in addition to the wave function, was the electric field. So you basically have a wave functional over electric field configurations. You also have a Bohmian electric field that undergoes some trajectory in the space of electric field configurations. You could equally well do this for the magnetic field. Although Bohm did it just for the free electromagnetic field, later people introduced models of fermions. So Bell has a model of fermions, which is a bit unlike the rest of the models insofar as it's indeterministic and discrete. So it's you have basically your supplementary variables are now fermion number at points on the lattice. So you can say I either have zero or one fermion at this point in the lattice. I can think of that as an extra degree of freedom, which supplements the wave function to provide a complete description of reality. And then you have dynamics that say, you know, if I have an excitation here, maybe it moves to the next lattice point, and there's a guidance equation for how those fermion numbers evolve. So you can combine that with Bohm's model and have a Bohmian version of QED. And there's also Samuel Collin, who is also a postdoc here, has a continuum version of this model of Bell's. There are other approaches which try to use Grassmann value variables as the supplementary variables, but those have been well criticized. It's not clear you can really pull that off. But an alternative to this, again in the theme of underdetermination, that there are multiple possibilities for reproducing the same operational predictions, Ward Stroebe and Hans Westman, while they were here, came up with something analogous to Bell's minimal model of spin, but now for quantum electrodynamics. So there they said, look, we just use either the magnetic or the electric field as our supplementary variable. There's no variables for the fermions, right? No variables for the matter. But the point is that the electric, just as over here, every time you measured spin, you were really revealing something about the particle positions. In their model, when you do a measurement on the matter, you're learning something about the electromagnetic field. And so the idea is, roughly speaking, the electromagnetic field carries information about the charges, right? So, you know, Gauss's law sort of suggests that if I knew everything about the field, well, I would know what, everything about the charge as well. And in their model, all measurements of the fields, all measurements of the matter degrees of freedom ultimately correspond to learning something about the fields. So once again, you have this choice of what you want to introduce as the additional reality in your model. Finally, this is a penultimate example. If you look at the guidance equation, there's again some freedom there. So this is work by Piotto and Girardi. The idea is to modify the guidance equation. So this is the original guidance equation, right? The velocity is the gradient of the phase of the wave function over m. I showed you that this could be rewritten as a probability current over r squared.
And what they say is, suppose you come up with some new probability current field. It's not defined from the wave function. It's just something you've invented. And it's arbitrary, except for the fact that it's divergenceless. And you add that into the guidance equation. What happens? Well, it turns out you can prove that this also preserves the standard distribution. So it's also going to reproduce the predictions of quantum mechanics. Let me show you what the proof of that is. Here's the proof we went through last time for the fact that the standard distribution is preserved by the guidance equation. So we had this velocity field. We defined the current density in terms of it. We used the conservation of probability here. And then we used this imaginary part of the Schrodinger equation, took the difference between these guys, and concluded that if rho, the distribution of the Bohmian positions, coincided with r squared at one time, then ddt of that difference is 0, so it coincides at all later times. So I add in this extra term now, divergenceless probability current. And so it reappears here. So let me just show you. Previously, I had rho times grad s because I was defining j in terms of rho and v was just grad s. But now I've added a term here, so I add a term here, and it becomes added in here. So that's what I've got here, grad s plus this extra term. But now because there's this gradient outside the front, when I take the gradient of this term, it goes to 0. So it just gives me what I had before, and the argument goes through. So I can add any current field, any divergenceless current field I want. I get new dynamics. All the particles move in different ways. But the overall distribution of the particles remains consistent with the quantum probabilities. So this will also reproduce operational quantum mechanics. And again, you have an infinite number of possibilities for this extra field. So is it really that time? Final comment is that you get a failure of Lorentz invariance. So at the even if you take one of these relativistic quantum theories that I talked about, like, say, the electrodynamics of free fields, when you look at the evolution of the fields, you find that there's not a Lorentz invariant description of them in the underlying hidden variable model. All the statistical predictions are Lorentz invariant, but the underlying hidden variable model is not. That's just what I said. So it implies that in these models, there's some unobservable preferred rest frame. Unobservable because you just have your experimental statistics. You don't have direct access to the Bohmian degrees of freedom. And so this is a kind of underdetermination because there's lots of choices for that preferred rest frame, and they all make exactly the same predictions. So one response that could be made to a lot of these cases of underdetermination that I've talked about is that if quantum mechanics is wrong, and there's really this non-standard distribution, we're outside of quantum equilibrium, then we'll be able to distinguish different preferred reference frames, different choices of dynamics, different choices of the supplementary variables. They'll all make different predictions once we go beyond the quantum predictions. So that's one of the reasons that's a nice position to be in, to believe that the wave function only has an ontic role to play, and psi squared is just an approximate description of the distribution of Bohmian particles, because you have a response to all of these arguments. So let me end there for today, and tomorrow we'll talk about collapse theories.